Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and go to Cairo, Egypt to speak with Thanasi Kambanis, the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. With a tense situation in Lebanon following the UN indictments of four members of Hezbollah accused of assassinating former Lebanese Prime Minister Hariri, we will talk about the wider regional implications of this explosive situation that is akin to the Guns of August tinderbox that preceded World War I. Then we'll examine further the scenario based on warnings from senior Israeli intelligence officials that Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu will launch a war against Iran as early as September. MJ Rosenberg joins us. He is a senior fellow at Media Matters, focusing on foreign policy and Middle East affairs. We will discuss the domestic political implications on the forthcoming elections should such a scenario unfold. Then finally, we'll speak with David Leventhal, the editor of a new report by the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics, From Hired Guns to Hired Hands. We will discuss the apparent lack of shame in Washington, D.C., where it is becoming more and more business as usual to trade public service for private gain, as the revolving door between lobbyists and congressional staffers spins faster and faster. Joining us now from Cairo, Egypt, is Thanasi Kambanis, who is the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. Thanasi Kambanis was the Boston Globe's Middle East Bureau Chief and now writes regularly for the New York Times as a freelance journalist. He also teaches journalism and foreign policy at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thanasi Kambanis.
Great to talk to you, Ian.
And Monday's New York Times had an editorial titled, The Long Pursuit of Justice in Lebanon. No matter what Hezbollah says, the men accused of Rafik Hariri's murder must be arrested. So easier said than done.
Yeah, I mean, the it would be a fool's bet to expect those four Hezbollah operatives named in the indictment to ever actually be arrested. You'll recall, and you might have talked about this last night with your guest Bob Baer, for decades there was an international manhunt for Imad Muhniyeh, who was Hezbollah's head of operations and was responsible for a lot of the major attacks on American targets in the 80s. That man was never caught, never captured. Eventually he was assassinated in 2008 in Damascus after a nearly three-decade international search. And if anything, that's the kind of result that we might see in this case. But we're very unlikely to see these people being actually found and arrested and put on trial.
Well, there's a fear, obviously, that pressure on Hezbollah, who are the de facto power now in Lebanon, will result in a resumption of the civil war. And, of course, the person who was largely credited with ending the civil war and healing the country was Hariri himself, the man who was assassinated and whose death has resulted in two UN tribunals, the second one finally coming out with the indictments against these four Hezbollah people, which I think if they're not arrested by August, I believe it is, then an international manhunt will begin. That's the countdown, right?
Right. And in practical terms, the tribunal has a process built in to put these people on trial in absentia. So if, as I would predict, they never get arrested, the court at some point, I forget what the time frame is, can go ahead and initiate proceedings. They'll be tried in absentia, and you know, if convicted, they'll have outstanding sentences against them. But really, I mean, the danger when people talk about this leading to civil war, the danger would lie in somehow a scenario where either the international community or the Lebanese government actually goes in, so to speak, with guns blazing into Hezbollah areas and really tries to force the issue and capture these guys, sort of, you know, an Osama bin Laden manhunt kind of situation. And that, in my view, is just never going to happen. I mean, in the reality of Lebanon's fragmented power structure in which Hezbollah holds the majority, if not all, the cards, there's simply no one strong enough to even make an effort to do this, much less to sort of mount a credible attempt to really arrest a Hezbollah person. So I think we'll see a lot of political rhetoric, but I can't even see a player who would be strong enough on the scene to sort of turn over the deck of cards and turn this into a real shootout.
Well, I think though the reason this is a subject I think of great interest beyond the UN tribunal and these four Hezbollah who have been indicted, this could be a flashpoint for a region that is teetering. Whether you've got the Syrian regime next door teetering, and we've already seen how Bashar al-Assad, first of all, he's blaming all of his problems at home on the Israelis and the Americans, which is what Hezbollah does as well. But he clearly tried to play the Palestinian card by threatening Israel and by creating problems for Israel, which I think was a way of telling the Israelis, you know, if I go, I'm going to make life miserable for you. And I think surely the same is happening in Lebanon, surely. Aren't the Syrians basically saying, if you push too far, we can really screw this place up?
You know, I think you're absolutely right that this could be a flashpoint for a wider conflict, and that Hezbollah would be one of the key destabilizing ingredients. The only difference in emphasis I would put is that I don't think it's the tribunal that's going to be the issue that puts their back up against the wall. I think you put your finger on it when you talked about the insecurity or the threat to the Assad regime, and that's where we get the weak link that could really set off a regional war. And the problem there is this: Syria is one of the two main backers of Hezbollah, along with Iran. And if you look at a map, you see exactly why Syria is so important. They share the land border. They effectively envelope Lebanon. That's where all the weapons come in. That's the strategic depth that allows Hezbollah to be such a formidable army. Now, Hezbollah looks around and sees its sponsor in Damascus on the verge perhaps of losing its regime, and they've come out very strongly in support of Assad, which by the way runs very counter to their usual position of being against Arab dictators. And I think if they see Syria about to go down in flames, or not Syria but the Syrian regime that has been its guarantor, I think they will do anything within their power, anything short of destroying their own organization, to keep that lifeline and pipeline open to them. And that is a very dangerous position for the region to be in.
Again, I'm speaking with Thanasi Kambanis, author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And we're speaking to Thanasi in Cairo, Egypt. Within the Lebanese government, of course, you have this the son of the murdered former prime minister, the head of the Future Movement, a former prime minister, Saad Hariri. He's basically saying that the bottom line is that there'll be no national dialogue unless they can discuss the issue of Hezbollah's arsenal, and that seems to be the breaking point. And of course, most of the members of the future movement say that Hezbollah is a tool of Bashar al-Assad, and that this is in fact the current prime minister is in fact a Makati. He's in fact a Hezbollah Syrian tool. So you got a kind of divided standoff and a stalemate there politically,
right? And let's try and untangle that mess of conflicting loyalties and interests here, and look at the cleavages that are most important for us and sort of most dangerous for the region. And I would say the biggest thing that's emerged from this is that the whole issue has been turned for a lot of people into a sectarian Sunni Shia issue. So whatever Rafiq Hariri represented at the time of his death in 2005, and whatever Hezbollah represented at the time as well, when Hezbollah was a sort of anti-Israeli umbrella resistance group and Hariri was a symbol of the rejuvenation of Lebanon, well, now for many people it's become Rafiq Hariri, a great Sunni leader, and Hezbollah, the great Shia hope. And that is the kind of thinking and the kind of polarization that did pave the way to a civil war in Lebanon, and unless we forget the relevance of that, that also fueled the far more murderous civil war in Iraq that still flares up to this day. And that kind of thinking, I find probably one of the scariest long-term legacies of this the murder and then the effort to bring it, the killers of Hariri to justice. Because in my view, whatever happened with Hariri was more complex than that. I mean, it certainly must have involved Syrian intelligence. It must have involved Hezbollah operatives who have such control on the ground, and it probably involved Lebanese intelligence as well. But today, it's a Sunni-Shia question, and that, frankly, riles people up a lot more than complex politics.
And, of course, the situation in Syria is a Sunni, Alawite, and Shia divide with a 15% minority against an 80% majority of Sunni. And I don't know whether you were able to hear all of the interview I did yesterday with Bob Baer, but it was pretty disturbing, his analysis based upon statements from senior Israeli intelligence officials that Prime Minister Netanyahu is determined to attack Iran, and may well happen as soon as September before Palestinians declare statehood. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, it's a terrifying cost-benefit analysis, because you know, a few years ago, I would have said that there were a lot of mitigating factors in the region. A lot of the most violent players had built-in incentives for calm. They were likely to do better with peace than war, even if they were largely belligerent. Now that's turned over on its head. So you and Bob talked about the Israeli and the Iranian calculus and to the Syrian calculus, and let's throw into that Hezbollah's as well. Hezbollah needs war if its domestic legitimacy is threatened, and it needs war if its viability as a militant movement is threatened. So either force, and right now those forces are coming down it from both directions, right? Inside Lebanon, there's a groundswell of support for bringing Hezbollah to trial and convicting it for this murder. Outside of Lebanon, its two biggest patrons are under attack, Syrian's regime literally, and that's the kind of moment where Hezbollah could see this as an existential issue and might well view it in their interest. Forget about what Syria wants or what Iran wants or Israel wants. Hezbollah might see it in its interest to spark a war with Israel, which, among other things, would rally a lot of Arabs in support of Syria and of Hezbollah. I mean, even if Hezbollah starts a war, once the war starts, everybody's going to side with the Arab underdog in the face of the Israeli Goliath, and that's really the trump card they hold, and they have access to that more so than a state like Syria. I think it's a little harder for a government like Syria, even in its current precarious situation, to just start a war. Hezbollah can do it any day. With there's always a little border dispute. There's always a little tension between the Israeli troops on one side of the border and the Hezbollah fighters on the other. And any one of those daily tiny things that we don't even hear about in the news could serve as the pretext for the movement to start a war if they so wanted.
Well, surely, though, if a war were to happen between Israel and Iran, the Israelis would simultaneously strike Iran and Hezbollah, wouldn't they?
You know, that's a question there's been a lot of debate on, and my position has always been that Hezbollah would not attack on Iran's behalf. That in general, Hezbollah does not want to be seen by its followers as serving the interests of a foreign nation. Its wars and its militant activity are always framed in terms of protecting Lebanon or protecting Hezbollah's ability to wage resistance against Israel. So, in the event of an Israeli attack on Iran, I think Hezbollah would be hard pressed to simply jump in. Now, if Israel attacked, of course they would counterattack, and they would, you know, perhaps be thrilled to have the pretext. And I believe that Israel might in fact refrain from attacking Hezbollah as well. I mean, if it thinks it could keep calm on its northern border while having a war with Iran, I think it would do so if it could.
Well, in both cases, if Israel attacked either Iran or Hezbollah, it would be a gift to Iran and Hezbollah. I think that was pretty much established in the conversations yesterday with...
Right, and sorry, I want to be clear. These actors have a long history of miscalculating. So
sure.
everything I said that sort of hinges on calm and clear assessments of their own self-interest and how a war would unfold... to be realistic in the environment that we've had over the last couple of decades, every time there's been a crisis, especially the Hezbollah and the Israelis have overshot, miscalculated, jumped the gun, and have been all too willing to sort of make a bad scenario into the worst case scenario. So probably the smart bet would be on either the worst or the sort of the dumbest strategic decision making.
Well, I think what we're talking about here, in a way, is a kind of Guns of August pre-World War I situation. And again, I'm speaking with Thanasi Kambanis, author of A Privilege to Die: Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And he's talking to us from Cairo, Egypt. And I was not able to talk about this subject that we're talking about today with Bob Bay yesterday because he was an investigator for the UN Tribunal and is under a gag order. But he has been threatened by Hezbollah's leader, Sheikh Nasrallah.
I don't think Bob Bear is on Hezbollah's sort of birthday card list. I don't think they're big fans of his. Certainly his role working with the tribunal was a good opportunity for them to demonize both him, but I think more importantly for their purposes, the tribunal itself. In his speech this past week, Nasrallah spent a lot of time explaining once again to his supporters how, in his view, the tribunal is simply an Israeli and American plot to enslave Lebanon to the interests of the West. One of the pieces of evidence that he very proudly trotted out was Bob's role as an investigator for the tribunal. In fact, Nasrallah listed by name several of the investigators who worked in the tribunal and explained their own CVs and their connections to the CIA or the FBI, their ties to Israel, and used that to show that, of course, the entire project of blaming Hezbollah is simply part of a Western Israeli-American plot to frame the honorable resistance as evildoers. It seems incredible from the outside, but virtually everyone in Hezbollah's community has for years now been 100% convinced that the murder of Hariri and, in fact, all the political assassinations in Lebanon were done by Israel. And Nasrallah has proved this, in air quotes, to his followers using sophisticated projections of drone footage and these sort of complicated circumstantial evidence cases and facts like Bob Baer's presence on the team that investigated the murders to provide what they see as an airtight case that Israel did this. And now, when I look at this case, it seems almost laughable. I mean, it's not something that would... I think even a two-bit defense attorney would trot out in a criminal court in the States, but it's been enough for his followers, and that kind of thing really motivates people and really sells. And the idea that if a former CIA officer was pinning this crime on Hezbollah, that's all the explanation you need in order to blow off the entire process if you're a Hezbollah loyalist.
Sure, and to that extent, Bob was tailor-made for Nasrallah, but. Nasrallah added a whole other bill of particulars against Bob and Hezbollah's. I wouldn't want to be on their hit list. Shall we say that? Because they've hit a lot of people around the world. In the last couple of minutes, though, I just wanted to ask you about the position there in how this is looked upon, particularly what's happening in Syria, where you are in Cairo, Egypt, because the Egyptians who led their revolution have their own problems and the extent to which the military are dragging out the process of of the fruits of revolution, if you will, and they're making the cutting these secret deals with the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, the revolution in Cairo is really entering another activist phase. The people who took it to the streets in January and February and toppled Mubarak, at this point feel like almost nothing has changed since the president left. The same military generals are running the country with the same structures, and frankly, they're right. I mean, it's still a military dictatorship, and there still has not been any firm timeline placed to put Egypt under civilian authority. So I think the Egyptians feel, on the one hand, lucky when they look at Syria and Libya. They see their brothers in the Arab Spring being killed wholesale by dictatorships that are taking a maximalist position to crush dissent. On the other hand, they feel like they're in a pretty tough position as well. I mean, several dozens of Egyptians have been killed in clashes since the revolution with the army, and the army has really been reluctant to give up any of its prerogatives. So I think for the view from Cairo is that Egypt is in a fortunate position. I mean, that it's more likely than most of the states in upheaval to get some substantial change without having a lot more people die. But they did have 1,000 people killed, and I think they look with a lot of pride at their fellows in Syria and Libya and Yemen, who are standing firm and really, being killed daily or weekly as they stand up for these ideals.
I share that feeling too. I'm astounded at the courage of particularly the young Syrians. Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Thanasi Kambanis.
Great to talk to you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Thanasi Kambanis, author of Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. He spoke to us from Cairo, Egypt. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a minute. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is MJ Rosenberg, who is a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, focusing on foreign policy and Middle East affairs. Previously, MJ Rosenberg served as a director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum. And prior to that, he served as chief of staff to the head of the Eastern European Bureau of USAID. He spent 18 years within the U.S. government, 14 on Capitol Hill as a congressional aide. Welcome to Background Briefing, MJ Rosenberg.
Thank you, Ian.
And yesterday, Bob Baer, the former CIA operations officer, who was portrayed by George Clooney in the movie Syriana, he spent a lot of time in Lebanon working against Hezbollah.
George Clooney.
Pardon?
Is he as good looking as George Clooney?
Yeah, actually, in a way, he is.
Oh, very cool. Okay.
So he laid out this pretty scary scenario yesterday, which was based upon warnings from senior Israeli intelligence officials, and you have to repeat who they are: the former head of Mossad, the former head of military intelligence, the former head of Shin Bet, the FBI equivalent, and the chief of staff, General Ashkenazi. So some heavyweight Israelis are weighing in. You can read about it in the Israeli press. You can't read about it in the American press. What do you think's going on?
Well, it's hard to believe that these guys would be issuing warnings. Basically, what they're saying, and it was the just retired head of the Mossad, Meir Dagan, who was the most specific about it, he said that basically the Prime Minister Netanyahu and the defense minister Ehud Barak are hell bent for a war with Iran, not necessarily a wake up one morning there's a massive attack, so that's a possibility, but more like setting up a series of incidents that will lead to war, both for Israel and for us. And he's saying that that all the personnel in the security establishment who would be fighting against this war and would be, it would instead be pushing up the peace process, are now out. They're now all retired. They're all out of the government. It sounds like they're almost all out because of disgust, though to a certain extent you'd want them to stick around. They see no breaks. I think that they got together, they're issuing a warning both to the Israeli people and to the United States to look at, just like Baer said yesterday, that something is going to happen very soon. And I don't think these guys are not playing politics. They're not politicians.
So in a way, though, a similar situation exists here, it would seem, based on the conversations yesterday, that Bob Gates having left the scene, there aren't too many strong voices in the National Security Council, in the White House, that don't have such strong ties to Israel in terms of AIPAC.
Well, we have a pretty weak National Security Council now. I mean, it's really, it's just there's nobody there who is playing a strong position of standing up to the president and telling him what he may not want to hear. Secretary Gates had this unique standing because of all his long tenure at the Defense Department, with someone who was not afraid to tell the president, the way he sees things. And we know that was opposed to any of these Iran adventures. I would say there's no one there like that now. It's certainly not the NSC, not the State Department. I don't really know, or maybe you do, about, where Panetta is. He's a politician. He was a member of Congress. He was a White House chief of staff. I suppose he has the clout that he could try to play the Gates role. But I'm not sure. He's a new guy. He's a new guy at the Pentagon, and I'm not sure he's got that kind of standing.
Well,
even if his inclinations are the same.
Sure. Well, he's just been in Iraq, where he's warned that Iran is arming the Shia militias,
right?
Which, of course, Iran just denied.
Right.
I think that's an ongoing situation. And in fact, if you really do a tally on the entire Iraq war, I understand you'll find that half of the Americans killed were actually killed by Iranian proxies. So they've always had, a bigger role than we've wanted to admit. And
right.
The U.S. is incredibly vulnerable there, even though there's been a drawdown of troops. Equally, the U.S. is incredibly vulnerable in Afghanistan. So
right.
These are the issues which I kept asking these guys yesterday. Surely the military are weighing in. And their answer was, yes, the military hate wars. They'd like to prevent wars. But once they're in them, they have to win.
Right.
And if Israel drags them in, so be it.
We had this, remember there was that hint of what the military was thinking when General Petraeus spoke honestly before that Senate committee. Remember around a year and a half, 2 years ago, in which he said that at that point as the head of CENTCOM, he felt that the continuation of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and any kind of exacerbation with Iran would endanger all of U.S. interest in the region, starting with American forces. And if he almost instantly, he tried to take it back, but he said it was on the record. And I think I hear that's what everyone in the military says. Everyone I talk to who goes to any of the war colleges or in Washington or to West Point or Annapolis and talks to military people, they do not share this Israel is always right attitude that the that the civilians in our government have. They've always been skeptical about this strategic relationship. They don't see it as all that strategic or all that strategically valuable. They see it as strategically dangerous.
So, again, I'm speaking with MJ Rosenberg, as a senior fellow at Media Matters, focusing on foreign policy and Middle East affairs. So, since in an earlier life, in 82 to 86, you were the editor of the Near East Report, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, APEX, biweekly publication on Middle East policy. Can you give us some insight then into, we saw the, I think, ultimately a shameful display of fealty that the Congress has towards APEC when Netanyahu addressed them. And Netanyahu was invited over here by Eric Cantor in a clear usurpation of the Congress's role in foreign policy, forcing the president to go make a speech just before Netanyahu arrived at the State Department to get the jump on him.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a pretty shameful display, didn't you think?
Right.
And so what's the what will happen if this happens? How do you think it's going to affect the elections? And do you think that Obama, as the people said yesterday, they don't think he's strong enough to resist if this happens? They'll just have to go along with it. What's your analysis?
As you mentioned, I worked at APEC 20-some years ago, and, before Oslo, before the Rabin-Arafat handshake, and I changed my views. APEC, in fact, went the other direction, and that's why I fight them as much as I do now, because they're really a force against any kind of negotiated peace or anything like that. And they're obviously the leading hawks on Iran in this city, in Washington, D.C. I believe that if Israel attacked Iran tonight, by tomorrow, the first thing that would happen tomorrow in Congress would be Democrats and Republicans, including even most of your California liberal Democrats, not all, but most, would be rushing down to the House floor to say that the United States has to stand with Israel, and we have to get, Israel's fight is our fight. And that's exactly what Israel's counting on. In other words, they could start a war with Iran, but they can't finish a war with Iran. Only we can do that. And they are counting on the fact that the Congress would be for it, which it would, Democrats and Republicans. I really like to emphasize that, because there are too many liberals out there like myself who think that, just because you're a liberal or you're anti-Iraq war, that must mean that you get Israel-Palestine. But it's not true. They all make a big exception, most of them, for Israel-Palestine when they suddenly become, big hawks. So I think that the Congress would support Israel and think to say America has to stand with Israel and fight Iran. And I think that President Obama, as far as I can see, just doesn't have it in him to stand up to the lobby. I mean, he's caved repeatedly. I mean, really, the Israelis have kicked sand in his face, and he's put up with it. No doubt he's mad having Netanyahu. I mean, what do you use that phrase, that the president of the State Department to get the jump on a foreign prime minister? It's crazy. You said it exactly right. It's crazy.
Well, let's just in the last minute, I just wanted a quick change of subject here, because sure, it involves your organization, Media Matters. Fox News has a jihad against Media Matters. They're really going to town. They're trying to break the tax-exempt status and get the IRS on sick them onto you. Is this anything new, or is this just business as usual?
It's just they're trying to, make it. They're always going after Media Matters. Now they're doing tax status. But, everyone we talk to, and obviously we talk to lots of people, every expert says we absolutely nothing to worry about there. We're fine. But they'll keep, they really hate us after we brought down Glenn Beck. I mean, not that the, we're okay. But I'll tell you, this climate in Washington, D.C. now is just really, really tough. In so many ways, if you're at all a progressive, I mean, it's just rough. And this Iran thing could be the worst foreign policy debacle yet. And according to your guys yesterday, it's looming right out there, right after the summer.
So what do you think that Murdoch's troubles in England are going to weaken him? And will the junkyard dogs in the fox pound still be gnashing their teeth?
Well, I think what's going on in England is certainly obviously the whole organization is shaken up, but I don't think we've seen it yet over here. It's kind of helpful though. I see that Senator Rockefeller from West Virginia came out and said that we should Congress should investigate the News Corp here. So did the right wing Congressman Peter King. So this can only weaken them. It's just. They have so much chutzpah, and they're just so arrogant in the way they go after people, and all of a sudden now they're so vulnerable. The idea of Murdoch having to give up on the Sky News deal today, that was the most humiliating thing in that guy's 80-year life. So I think this is one really... even though it's not our we don't think of the Murdoch as being this puppet master of American politics the way they see him in England and Australia. He is. Through Fox News, through the New York Post, through the Wall Street Journal.
Look at all the presidential candidates on the Republican side. Half of them are on the Fox payroll. I got to wrap it up now. I'm afraid, MJ. Okay. But I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with MJ Rosenberg as a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, where he focuses on foreign policy and Middle East affairs. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about this new report called about the revolving door between politicians and between lobbyists and congressional aides called From Hired Guns to Hired Hands. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. I'm now joined by David Leventhal, who is the Communications Director for the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics in Washington, D.C. He edited a new report the center has released on the revolving door of lobbyists and congressional staffers called From Hired Guns to Hired Hands. You can find it out at opensecrets.org. Before joining the Center for Responsive Politics, David Leventhal was an award-winning political reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Leventhal.
My pleasure to be here.
And again, this report's available at opensecrets.org. But let's get into the sort of headline, as it will. What is alarming about this is that the incredible increase, the number of former lobbyists working as key congressional staffers has more than doubled since the Republican Party took control of the House.
And what we found is that this has been something that has been occurring for many years. There have been lobbyists who become congressional staffers. There are congressional staffers more frequently that become lobbyists. And that's why we call it the revolving door of government, because there's this constant shuttling that's occurring between both government and the lobbying and political influence world. But at the end of the day, we find that this is happening to a greater degree today than it has been in just the past couple of recent years. And that may be of concern to some people because of the clients that some of these former lobbyists have represented, because some of the clients, many of the clients, in fact, have a great deal of business before the federal government. So it does raise, at least in some people's minds, conflict of interest issues and possibly the specter of them doing the bidding of their former employer. Now, other people may say that there's nothing wrong with this. This is just the way of government. But certainly in this report, we want to lay all of these facts bare and let people make a decision for themselves.
But your report finds that 128 former lobbyists work in key staff positions in the Congress compared to 60 in the last. So in the 112th, there's 128, in the 111th, there were 60. And what is interesting, at least, and to some extent ironic about this report, to my mind, David, is that a lot of the increase in lobbyists has been because they've joined the staffs of these brand new Republican representatives who were just elected in 2010, many of them Tea Party candidates who campaigned as anti-establishment outsiders.
This is true, and we found two in particular. Well, to step back just a second, there were about 38 freshman congressional members in the current Congress who have hired lobbyists to positions on their staffs. And Joe Manchin, a Democrat of West Virginia, and Marco Rubio of Florida have actually hired two lobbyists into their top positions, their legislative director position, their chief of staff position, which just speaks to the issue of this idea that lobbyists who have previously worked on behalf of corporations or unions or other special interests are now literally in a matter of sometimes weeks or months going and working for government. So, in effect, representing a private special interest and then turning around on a dime and representing a public interest, at least on behalf of a member of Congress who's been elected by the public to represent their interests in Congress.
So, David Leventhal, it looks like that these lobbyists slash staffers, former lobbyists now, congressional staffers, seem to have gravitated largely to the Financial Services Committee and the Energy and Commerce Committee. That's what the report seems to indicate.
Absolutely. And in doing this report and writing this report, we did look at the various committees, not only the individual members of Congress and their staffs, but the committee staffs in Congress to see where some of these former lobbyists are going. And what we did find is that the House Energy and Commerce Committee, the House Financial Services Committee, and the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, along with about 10 other committees, had at least 10 or more of these former lobbyists who are now working for them in a capacity for the committee, for this public interest work, again, as opposed to private special interest work.
Again, I'm speaking with David Leventhal from the Center for Responsive Politics, which has just released the new report that he edited, From Hired Guns to Hired Hands. The report's available at opensecrets.org. And now it looks like AT&T, in terms of the numbers of these lobbyists turned staffers, has got the most, right?
They do, in fact. So when we broke it down, we looked at not only the general industries and sectors from which these former lobbyists were coming, but looking at the companies themselves. And AT&T, which is a lobbying powerhouse, bar none, and certainly year after year spending a significant amount of money on political influence efforts, they had several of their lobbying alumni come and work for the current Congress. But there are plenty of other organizations, companies, be it what it may, who also fall on this list. And certainly as things go forward, we would expect that many other large companies who had lobbyists working for them, those lobbyists would find work in Congress as well. This certainly does seem to be a trend, and there being no stopping to this trend, whether you think it's a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, I think the real question, surely, David, comes down to whether it's even possible, and this is quoting from your report, to keep the wishes of their former clients separate from the wishes of the constituencies their bosses represent, and that everything from policy outcomes to government contract decisions and to antitrust decisions come into play here. Now, you've just brought up AT&T. They've got antitrust cases before them, surely.
And it's important to note that it's impossible to make a specific judgment on every single former lobbyist who goes and works in Congress. Every individual is different. Every person is different. They bring different experiences to the game. So to generally vilify them would be a fool's errand. But that all being said, you have companies like AT&T, who we've identified 13 of their former lobbyists as working in Congress. Lockheed Martin, a defense contractor, 9. Verizon, GlaxoSmithKline, Southern Company, Microsoft, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and on and on, and all of them have a significant number who do work in Congress now. They also have a significant amount of business before Congress, before the committees in which some of these former lobbyists are now working. So there is a certain familiarity, there's a certain degree of connection that you can have as a company if you have some of your former lobbyists, some of your former advocates working for you. And as just a general member of the public, some people may have concerns about that because they might feel like the system is gamed. They might feel as if those companies that are trying to get a certain tax policy to fall their way or get a certain agreement with the government to go in their direction might have an advantage in a situation like that because they have people who have such a familiarity, used to dry paycheck from them, again, working on the other side, working on the committee, working for a certain member of Congress, and being able to perhaps grease wheels in order to have their former employer get some sort of advantage.
Well, I recall just after the 2010 elections that there was a lot of questions about the election of Senator Dan Coats in Indiana, who had previously headed up a lobbying company with a lot of big blue-chip Fortune 500 clients, including General Electric and Google. I think he had 36 clients amongst the Fortune 500. Now, he now sits on the Senate Appropriations Committee, the Select Intelligence Committee, the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, as well as the Joint Economic Committee. What's your understanding of where those questions lie now? Have they been satisfactorily answered?
It's, first of all, perfectly legal for that to happen. There is no prohibition on a former lobbyist holding office or a former lobbyist going to work for the government. Now, there are some prohibitions on former members of Congress or former top-ranking congressional staffers going to work as lobbyists and then directly lobbying their former colleagues, but it's only a one-year prohibition in the House, two-year prohibition in the Senate. Very easy, just after, you know, a short period of time, them to go back and lobby their former colleagues or former associates. But in the case of Coates and in a couple of other representatives over the years who have been in a similar situation, they very well will sit on a committee that has jurisdiction over the very companies that they used to lobby for. So at the end of the day, the constituents of that representative, of that senator, whoever it may be, will have to hold him or her accountable for their actions. And of course, they have the most power of all, which is the ability to vote him or her in or out of office. Watchdog groups, of course, though, it's up to them to monitor the action of those members to make sure that somebody is doing something for a public interest, for the interest of their constituents, and not doing so on behalf of a corporate interest or a special interest or a union interest, all of which are definitely going to Congress time and again, day after day, and spending, in some cases, millions, if not tens of millions of dollars every single year to try to influence various legislation and various policy decisions that are being made here in Washington, D.C.
Well, of course, this is a very different Washington, D.C. than it was even a decade or so ago. And one of the last interviews that Teddy Kennedy did, where he was reflecting back on his long service, because he was in the Senate longer than most of the senators around, and he said the fundamental difference was that we used to actually work in the Senate. We used to do a five-day-a-week, you know, like normal people. We worked 5 days a week. But nowadays, we basically get in on Wednesday, do a little bit of work on Thursday, and then we're back either at fundraisers or back in the district raising money. And that is the fundamental change. And, you know, I remember senators like Proxmire from Wisconsin, who gave out the Golden Fleece Award every year for the most outrageous waste of taxpayers' money. He routinely was reelected on $500 campaign. That's all he spent. And he was proud of it. What's happened to the culture of Washington? I mean, we recently had a case of a woman that was on the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, and then now she's become a lobbyist for one of the big media conglomerates. Absolutely no shame is like nothing. What's the problem? What's the problem here? You know, and I think a lot of people think there is a problem.
But it's not a unique story. The situation that you described, both with Ted Kennedy and the former commissioner and the FCC. Well, let's take the first one first. Have things changed in Washington, D.C. over the past 20, 30, 40 years? Absolutely. And if you talk to members of Congress or you talk to staffers or folks who just work here in D.C. about this cultural change, which has been written about numerous times in the Washington Post and other publications, they do kind of pine for those days. Even Betty Ford, of course, who just passed away a couple days ago, had lamented the change in the culture here in Washington, D.C. Now, you can argue whether that's a good thing or a bad thing about the fraternizing that used to take place that may not take place today, about the change in culture. Some people say, hey, you know, government is not about being a bunch of, you know, friends and making backroom deals with each other. This is a contact sport, and one side should fight against another. But other people say, well, our discourse in politics has become poisoned, has become toxic, and as a result, it's very difficult to actually do something and to actually pass laws that are worthwhile, to actually move the country forward. So there is a philosophical divide to be had there. On your latter point about the revolving door again between government and politics, that's just one of quite literally thousands of examples that we could point to of somebody who serves in government and oftentimes will have a very powerful position, a top-ranking staffer, a former member of Congress, who will go and then begin to lobby the government, oftentimes drawing a very significant high-dollar salary to do so. And they effectively cash in their Rolodex. They cash in their experience. They cash in the time that they've spent representing the public, and then they are able to benefit themselves, their pocketbook, as a result of that. So on one hand, everyone is entitled to being able to work, to have a job, to put bread on their table. On the other hand,
let's not shed too many tears for the people in Washington.
They've all got
jobs.
My point.
the people out in America don't have jobs. That's the difference.
Exactly, and that's the other side. The tale here is that people are getting elected to serve the public good, to serve a district, a constituency. And then all of a sudden they go away, or they're in an appointed position to do what's, of course, again, on behalf of the public good, and then they cash in that experience for their own good. So it creates a degree of cynicism among people, especially those who are out of work, who are struggling mightily economically, and they see these people who one day are representing them going ahead and working for a pharmaceutical company or a manufacturer or a labor union or another type of interest group and being paid very handsomely for that. And they're just kind of sitting there back at home, wherever they may be, in California or Florida or Kansas or wherever in the United States, kind of scratching their heads saying, well, you know, what happened to me? What about me? What about those promises that were made when I voted for this person to represent me in Congress?
Well, David Leventhal, though, I think there's a distinction here worth making. What Betty Ford, who just died, was saying was that she missed the days when Republicans and Democrats on the Hill and in the Senate in general and the House were friends, family friends, lifelong friends, and that doesn't happen anymore. It's much more polarized. That's a separate issue, though, from the culture of trading public service into private gain in a revolving door where the door revolves a lot faster. And my understanding from the report that you edited is that there is a change. Isn't that what the report's saying? That there's a hell of a lot more of this happening now. Lobbyists becoming staffers, it's almost doubled.
It has, and in a very short period of time. So as a result of this, we feel it's very important to train a light on this. And again, you can agree that this is a good thing or a bad thing, or argue on one side or the other, but our job here, as we fashion it, is to show people that, first of all, this is happening. Put hard numbers on it, put real names on it, so that you as a citizen, if you care about your civic duties, if you care about your community, your country, can very clearly see who is doing what and to what degree. And that's very powerful information, especially as somebody who wants to be an informed voter, who wants to make informed decisions about their participation in politics and ultimately who they vote for when they go to the ballot box.
Well, I understand that you are a nonpartisan organization, and you try to be so. So I guess you can leave the outrage to me and our audience, because I guarantee you people in this country, particularly, as you mentioned, people out of work, are outraged by this, particularly the notion that public service is so devalued by quickly cashing in. There doesn't seem to be much shame about doing it anymore. That's and again the case with the FCC, woman with the FCC, where her attitude was, "What's the problem?" You know. So if we've reached a point where there's no moral sanction, then it's a pretty sad day.
And if outrage is the result of this, so be it. We want to make sure that we're not coloring the facts any which way, one way or another, but that people, regardless of whether you're a Democrat, a Republican, a liberal, a conservative, an independent, or anywhere in between, that you can read this, you can see it, and you can make of this what you will. Certainly we've had a lot of people who have read this report over the past day, people who participate in a live web chat that we did about the findings, who are outraged about this. And we would encourage anyone, regardless of how you feel about this, to read it and to also act on it however you see fit.
And people can do that by going to opensecrets.org. I thank you for joining us, David Leventhal.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David Leventhal, who's a communications director for the nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics. He edited the new report the center has released on the revolving door between lobbyists and congressional staffers, called From Hired Guns to Hired Hands. Again, you can find the report at opensecrets.org. What did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we tried to follow on from yesterday's program, where a former senior CIA officer, Bob Baer, said that a war with Iran is inevitable, in the sense that the Israeli top intelligence people have been warning the Israeli public that Netanyahu and a hawkish clique around him are determined to attack Iran, and soon. So I talked with Thanasi Campanis, who has written a book about Hezbollah. Hezbollah are key to this, because Hezbollah will be unleashed by Iran. And we got into the whole subject of, which I couldn't talk to Bob Baer about yesterday because he was on the UN tribunal that looked into the assassination of Hariri. And he's been blamed by Hezbollah as being a CIA, part of a CIA Israeli-American plot. And he wasn't able to talk because of he's got a gag order from the UN. So I covered that territory with Thanasi Campanis, who explained how dangerous it is to have a hit out on you from Hezbollah, but also the complications of Lebanese politics and how this places a whole kind of tinderbox, very reminiscent of the Guns of August tinderbox that preceded World War One. Then we talked further about the scenario with MJ Rosenberg with Media Matters. He used to work for AIPAC, and he was able to give us a real insight into the domestic political situation here in the United States, where he said that if Israel were to attack Iran, the very next day everybody in Congress would be cheering them along and passing resolutions in support of Israel, and that he doesn't believe for one second that President Obama will take on the lobby, because he has proven incapable or afraid to do so up until now. So he takes that scenario very seriously and says basically that we shouldn't underestimate the possibility that this could happen, and happen soon. So then we talked about this new report from the Center for Responsive Politics, From Hired Guns to Hired Hands, with the editor of the report, David Leventhal. And this is a very depressing report, which shouldn't come as a surprise, but it clearly indicates the extent to which it's becoming more and more business as usual in Washington to trade public service for private gain. And, of course, the revolving door between lobbyists and congressional staffers is spinning faster and faster, with this year almost doubling the number. And incidentally, most of these lobbyists who work for congressional staffers work for the newly elected Tea Party people, giving you an idea of the utter hypocrisy of the Tea Party being a grassroots, anti-establishment, anti-Washington group out to change the system. What an absolute hogwash. That's the way it is. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available at ianmasters.com. And I will be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.